Prayers are really a blessing. And part of what you said is what Bonnie and I prayed every day for our children. We would put our hands on them and say, we pray that you love the Lord and serve the Lord and grow up to be godly men and women. And what a joy. Okay, where'd we leave off on reading? Because we're going to need some readers. Who was the last one to read scripture? I guess we'll just start with Ellen then. We'll come to the front row. And what we're looking at today is the hardest part. Think of this. How does God deal with people that have never heard the gospel? Did you catch what I said? What about the Aborigines in Australia? What about the Pygmies in Africa? What about the tribal people in New Guinea and Papua? What about all the tribes that live in valleys in India that hardly anybody's ever seen? They're so remote. What about those people? In America, the Eskimos, the Native Americans. In South America, all of those tribes that are headhunting, killing people. What about them? How does God deal with these kind of people? The what we would call tribal people that don't have a written language, that don't read books, that aren't on the internet, that have never heard the radio, and no missionary has ever gone to them. No missionary. Well, how does God do that? Do you ever think about that? What is God's plan for them? That's why Isaiah is so important. Isaiah explains what God is thinking and doing with these kind of people. So look where we are. God's expectations of his people and God's future plans for his people. As we look at Isaiah, he is speaking to the tribes of Judah, the southern Israel, the lower kingdom, the people that were still following him. And he's telling them what God expects from them and his plans. But this first part, the first 39 chapters, where we're going to spend all of this morning, is the gloomiest, darkest, hardest part. Because basically, God says, I still am holy, and I expect you to respond to that, even if you're a tribal person. So how can he do that? How can he expect people with bones in their noses to live a holy life if they've never read the Word of God? I mean, you talk about a question. Right after, have I committed the unpardonable sin in college campuses? Do you know what the second question is? What about the people who have never heard? Can God send those people to hell if they've never seen the Bible? That's a very, very important question. Okay, so we're going to look at that, especially the nations are judged there and the woes against Judah, those two sections. Now remember, for our quizzes and for our tests, and remember tomorrow you have your verse. Those of you that are going to make up Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 is tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll have a written quiz, and Friday we'll have a written quiz. And basically you're seeing what I'll ask you. I'll say the Messiah, you know, what chapters are the Messiah in, 7 to 12. Where does God describe the millennium in heaven, 58 to 66. But that's why I cover that. But now, Romans chapter 1, and Ellen is going to turn there to Romans chapter 1. And what we're going to look at is, how does God deal with the nations that haven't ever heard the gospel? And we're going to start in Romans 1, and Ellen is going to read verse 18, and then Zeph isn't going to read verse 19. Let me get to Romans 1. What we're looking at is the standard by which God judges people. And it says, Zeph's going to read 20. And then Elam is going to read 21. Okay, so let's start with Romans 1, 18, and first of all, Ellen.
For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth.
Okay, verse 19.
For what can be known about God is things that because God has shown it to them.
And verse 20. Whoa. Did you notice that what Ellen read is the character of God, the attribute of God called his wrath? That's one of the unchanging characteristics of God. It's just as much a part of his life as his love and as his mercy and as his grace. Actually, none of God's attributes are bigger than the others. The way to understand God's attributes are that they're not like a collection of little circles. If this is God, some people see wrath is right there, love is right there, grace is right here, and that's a big one. Mercy is big, but omniscience is a little one, and jealousy is over there. We don't know what to do with it. And it's like God has all these little parts. There are over 20 attributes of God. Characteristics, how he operates, his operating system. They're all equal. Basically, the theologians draw the attributes of God like this, and they just say they're just all like wrath, justice, mercy, love, holiness, grace, kindness. Immutability, are all just like slices of the whole, that God is all of these things all at once. He is perfectly wrathful, loving, mercy, gracious, omnipotent like that. But that means he is all of them all the time. It isn't like love all of a sudden overwhelms wrath. He is loving and wrathful, merciful and wrathful, gracious and wrathful, omnipotent and wrathful, kind and wrathful, jealous and wrathful. He is all of them. Or we can put it the other way. He is loving all the time and wrathful all the time. He's loving all the time and merciful. He's loving all the time and immutable. So, look at what those words say. All, whoever live, that means all of us. That's Adi and a Philistine. It's Caleb and a Babylonian. In other words, everybody that's ever lived are born, they come into the world with two candles. Now I know this, and so I've witnessed the birth of eight of our children, and as each one was born, I waited to see their candles come out. You can't see them. They aren't holding them in a literal sense. But the two candles are what God gives everybody in order to find him. It's kind of like if the power went out and it was nighttime and it was the ancient world, we would have oil lamps or candles and we would go around like this trying to see where to go. That's how God equips every human. And what are the two candles? They're what Ellen and Zeph and Elam read. Conscience. Everyone has a conscience. A conscience is God's ally. It's God's friend that he puts into every human being. It says in Romans 1, verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen and understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power, Godhead. That's the candle of creation. Then it says there, because they knew God, verse 21, didn't glorify him, they'd be futile in their thoughts and their foolish hearts were darkened. That's their conscience. Now I'll tell you a quick story. Do you remember the guy that took me all over Europe and took me in the back door and we ate in the big tank? Well, he also, on his oil ranch, when I went to visit him one day, he raised cattle, Barzona cattle. And a Barzona is a breed of Angus cows that are gigantic and black. And Texans love them because they make the best steaks, and they're just big on these big steaks, and they love meat. And so under his oil wells, he was raising these cows. And his mother, who drove us around in a Jeep, I mean, their ranch was 10,000 acres. I mean, it was 16 square miles. And she drove us around, and she says, "Hey, you're a preacher, aren't you?" I said, "Mm-hmm." She said, "I'm going to give you a sermon illustration you'll use the rest of your life." And she was a big, elderly Texan woman driving a Jeep, wearing a long dress and a great big hat. So out of, you know, it just didn't look like it went together. Big hat, fancy dress, cowboy boots and Jeep in a ranch. Okay, so we drove out next to a Barzona. Barzonas stand, I mean, their backs are about as high as my shoulder. I mean, they look like an elephant to me. They're gigantic creatures. On the side of them, they had brands. Do you know what a brand is? They take a symbol of the ranch, you know, like the triple bar, whatever their ranch logo is. This is metal, and it has a long handle, and they put it in a fire, and then they come up to the cow. I can't draw very well. There's a cow with big horns. And they put this thing on its side and go, and it makes that shape, and that's the mark that it belongs to that rancher. That's called branding. It sounds cruel, but that's what they've always done. They brand cows in those people that raise them in Western United States. I mean, millions of cows are branded with their ranch symbol. So here's this cow, and right on its side, it had that great big symbol burned right into it. You could see it. It actually burned away the hide and made this symbol. And the cow is chewing. And it's huge. And this woman said, "Watch, you'll never forget this." And she pulled out of her hat a hat pin. A hat pin is a pin, like a needle, that's about this long, that holds a hat on a woman's head when she has lots of hair. I don't know how it would work, but she had lots of hair and it would work. And so she pulled out her hat pin. It was a good this long. Walks up to that cow. And right where the brand was, she said, "Watch." And she went and poked the cow with the pin. I went back to the Jeep. Because you know what I thought he'd do? Kick her. The cow never stopped chewing. She poked him again. I said, "What are you doing?" She said, "He can't feel anything in that spot. His nerves have been seared. They've been by this brand. When they did it to the cow, the whole area no longer has feeling." You say, "What are you telling me? What a gross story, especially for people that love animals." That's what sin. Look at what it says in verse 21 of Romans. "Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful. They became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened." You know what that means? There are two candles. They come out at birth lighting the way. And what happens is a child will look at creation around it and see those azaleas right there and the grass and all those trees and the clouds and the stars, and they'll go, "Wow, where did all that come from?" And someone will say, "Don't worry about it, it evolved and you're evolving and there's no creator and that isn't true." And they go, "Okay," and they go and they blow out their creation candle. Because what does God say in verse 20? "For since creation, the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse." That's the candle of creation. And you know what God says? If you will take this candle and say, "I want to know the Creator, I want to know the Creator, I want to understand where I came from," God said that he will reveal himself to you. Where is that? That's in Acts 17. Acts 17, when Paul is teaching a group of pagans in Athens, which you will not go on your trip with Mark Strout and Steve Nichols, but they used to go there. What Paul said to those people is, he said, if you take your candle of creation and go, "Creator, I know you're out there. I can't see you. I want to know you." He Now watch this. In Paul's text, he said, if you reach out for him like this. You know, if I have my eyes closed and I'm trying not to hit anything, I go like this. And I'm feeling this. See, I can't feel it until I'm within an arm's length. See how close I have to get to feel it? Do you know what Acts 17 says? God is within arm's reach of all who have ever lived. God walks around staying this close so that he can be touched. That's what Acts 17, that's Paul's gospel presentation. If perhaps you will reach out for him, because he is, Paul said, not far from everyone. How do you reach out to him? There's only two avenues. Through natural revelation, general revelation, through creation, you say, who made this world? Secondly, through conscience. You know what conscience is? Conscience is that pesky thing that says, I don't think you should be driving your car that fast because the speed limit is 60 and you're going 80. Do you think you should be doing that? That's conscience. Conscience is saying, did you really tell the truth or did you exaggerate? That's conscience. Conscience says, do you think that you really should be doing that when you have so much homework to do? Do you really think you should be playing that game when you haven't read your Bible? That's called conscience. It's God's ally. It's his friend that lives within us. What happens to people? They become like cows. They get branded by, when you keep committing the same sin, it desensitizes us to God. We don't feel bad anymore. Did you know there are people, I read, one of you said, I didn't know laziness was a sin. You know, I loved reading all these Proverbs projects. And now some of you are already turning in Isaiah. I love reading your observations and your prayers. Because one of you said, I didn't know laziness was sin. I just thought it was fun to be lazy. And then the prayer, Lord, remind me that laziness is sin. Remind me you want me to serve you. See, a lazy person just keeps sinning, and every time you sin, it just desensitizes you, so pretty soon you don't even feel bad about laziness. You've hurt your conscience. That's what God said is dangerous. So all creation does that. Now, let's turn to Psalm 19, and we're going to go to Chrissy. And in Psalm 19, what we're going to find is, what about the native people that live, the Aborigines or the savages? How do they hear the voice of God? And God explains that in Psalm 19. And we're going to read, Chrissy's going to read verse 1, Cain is going to read Psalm 19, 2, and Ruth Ann, you get 3. And do you mind doing 4 too? You get a bonus. Because you have two names, Ruth Ann, so you get 3 and 4. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, Chrissy.
The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork.
Now pause. Do you see which candle we're talking about? The heavens are declaring the glory of God. By the way, I told you this earlier in Proverbs, glory in Hebrew means heaviness. What it's saying is the creation around us pushes down on us. It's like we feel wonder at the sunset and the stars and the moon and the trees and the wonders of life and the ocean. And that is saying somebody made all that. Now, for just a second, if you saw this, what's this? This is an iPhone made of what? What is it made of? Two substances primarily. Silicon and aluminum, okay? The outer shell is aluminum and the glass, heavy glass thing is made of silicon. That's what glass is made of. So here we are with a handful of silicon, which is another word for what? Sand. That's what silicon is, sand. It's one of the most common elements on Earth, okay? Silicon and aluminum. Now, if this was sitting, we were walking down Jeju's coast and on the black volcanic rock that was sitting there, I would go, wow, 12 billion years ago, some silicon started getting attracted to some aluminum. What's funny about that, Addie? That's called evolution. Right? it spontaneously, the silicon converted itself from sand to high pressure haptic touch sensitive glass. And the aluminum purified itself because it's never found in a pure state somehow, and it shaped itself into this beautiful shell because it liked the silicon so much. How long did this take? Billions and billions of years, right? How did it get this operating system that's so amazing, that does everything? It tells me the time, it takes pictures, it's my flashlight. It even has a picture of my favorite student right there on the front that comes up all the time. How does it do that? It just evolved, right? What I just said is what's taught in every Korean school, every American school, every Vietnamese school, every Taiwanese school, every school, even the Christian ones. Did you know there's only a handful, about five Christian universities in America that even believe in creationism? All the rest of them say evolution, evolution, evolution. Let me ask you, your students, and you can answer out loud. Did this phone evolve on a rock on Jeju Shore? Yes or no? All of you know.
No.
Say it a little more confidently.
No.
Where did this come from? Who thought of this first? Anybody know his name?
Company.
Yeah, Apple Company, but who started Apple Company?
Steve Jobs.
He would be called, listen, what do we call him? Creator. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows that. They know that in China, where they make all these things. They know this in Nepal, where they use these things. They know it in Africa, where they buy these things. They know. If I went to a school in Kenya, Nairobi, Africa, and I said, this evolved on Jeju Shore over billions of years, the students would all go, no, Steve Jobs created it. Everybody knows the creator of the iPhone. Nobody acknowledges the creator of the universe. Yet, we have more defining signatures of God than Steve Jobs has on that phone. There's more parts of you that only God could make that are amazing. When you look at the biochemical level, the molecular level, when you look at the enzymes that work inside of our body, when you look at the nerves, when you look at the communication system, it's impossible for that to evolve because it all had to come together at the same time to work. It's just like the iPhone. You couldn't evolve it. So we have these two things. So verse 1, we read. Now verse 2, Cain.
Day to day, pour forth speech, and night to night, and reveals knowledge.
So what does verse 2 say? God, actually, this is the first verse you have to learn in Hebrew class. Hashemayim mesaparim kevod el, we-la-la-le-la-la. That's the first, that's in Hebrew. There are a lot fewer Hebrew words, but Hashemayim, the heavens, Mesaparim, declare, Kevoz El, the glory of God. And the firmament shows his handiwork. But what it says in verse 2 is, all day long, creation is talking. And what creation is saying is, do you see how intricately everything around you is made? Someone had to make that. It's designed by someone, just like your phone is. You should get to know who created you. You should seek them. He's only an arm's length away. All you have to do is reach out in faith and say, I want to know you. Did you know my wonderful wife, Bonnie, in the middle of a snowstorm, I mean, feet of snow were falling like is happening in America right now. She was sitting reading the Bible and she sat there and went, God, if you're out there, I want to know. I want to meet you. And in her blindness, she was going like that. And she met him on January 18th, 17th, what? 18th? January 14th, 1978. She met God. Because what Cain just read, his voice is going throughout the earth to everybody. All who ever live are born with those candles. Okay, now Ruth Ann. 3 and 4.
There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Wow. And then he said, a tent for the sun.
Wow. God said, there's no language I'm not communicating in. There's no speech nor language. I've gone to every part of the world. Actually, Jesus put it this way in John 1. I am the light that lighteth everyone that comes into the world. I put those candles in everybody's hands, and all they have to do is go like that and reach out for me. So that's the stunning message. But in spite of that, the nations have been wicked. Everyone that's been born has done this. Threw away their candles. I'm going to make it on my own. I don't need God. What happens when you don't need God? Well, 2 Chronicles 16:9, Julia, you get to find that. 2 Chronicles, that's a really hard one to find. And Addie, you get to read, because you're such a good student, you get two verses, okay? Addie gets 2 Kings 8, 11, and 12. Now, the two things we're going to see, first from Julia, we're going to see how God, what he does all day long. You ever wonder what God does all day long? Do you ever think about that? 2 Chronicles 16:9 tells us that the eyes of the Lord are going all throughout the earth, and God is scanning everybody. He's like this. And what he's looking for, and it's figurative. God doesn't have eyes. You understand what I mean? He's a spirit. But what he's saying, it's called an anthropomorphism in English, which means God uses a term for humans so humans can understand what he's doing. And so we have eyes, so he says, my eyes, kind of like yours, because I made yours, are looking. And what is he looking for? Julia's going to tell us. So 2 Chronicles 16:9.
For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth, to give strong support to those who search in blindness toward him. He hath done foolish in this, for from now on you will have words.
So this is a really negative verse. God says, my eyes are looking for someone who's reaching out for me and wants to know me and obey me and follow me. That's what whose heart is blameless or perfect. But you've done foolishly. See, God is watching all the time. That's what his eyes run to and fro throughout the earth that Julie just read. God is watching everybody. He's watching right now what's going on in Hong Kong. Do you know what's going on in Hong Kong? Anybody watching the news? I mean, the Chinese government is trying to put down this rebellion, and they're shooting people. People are starting themselves on fire, you know, putting gasoline and burning themselves. They're breaking everything. It's just a big mess in Hong Kong right now because China wants absolute obedience to China, and people don't like to be told what to do. That's human nature. God sees that and everything else. He actually saw you that were sending me your projects at 10:09 last night. He was watching you. He was watching you. See, he watches all the time. But look at what he sees. Addie's going to read. This is something fascinating because nations have so been wicked in the sight of... Boy, that's not very good English. But nations have been wicked in the sight of the Lord. Addie, read about it.
And he fixed his place and stared at him until he was embarrassed, and the man of God wept. And Hazor said, why does my Lord weep? He answered, because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set a fire on their fortresses, and you will kill their young men with a sword, and dash in pieces in their little ones and ripple in their pregnant women.
Wow. If you were following along, horrible things. Dashing children to pieces. This Hazael, the Syrian, in the time of Elisha, which is 700 BC, was going to come with his army into a town, grab all the children, take them to the edge, and throw them and smash them like pumpkins or watermelons, like throwing people so they smash open and die. One. Second thing Addie said is worse. He was going to take his sword and every expectant woman, he was going to cut them open and kill the baby. That is about the grossest thing you could think of. But who saw it? God. Why is that wrong? Because God sets what is righteousness and what is not, what is wicked and what is not, and God is watching. Okay, by the way, where was where Addie was reading? What was the country this guy's from?
Syria.
Okay, now let's go to chapter 17 of Isaiah, because let me show you. Now we'll get really moving because the bell's going to ring in 12 minutes. Isaiah 17, and I'm going to need Cody to read verse 1 in just a minute. But look what God says. God predicts the destruction of Damascus. Damascus is the main city of Syria to this day. Okay? Now Cody is going to tell us what God said is going to happen in the city of Damascus. 17:1.
An oracle concerning Damascus. Behold, Damascus will cease to be a city and will become a heap of ruins.
Okay, God, in what Cody just read, predicts through Isaiah that Damascus is going to be destroyed. Now, here's something for your notes. Damascus, if you look it up on Wikipedia, in Google, in the National Geographic, or anywhere else, it has a real famous heritage. It is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. People have been living there as far back. They're still living there today. I have students that I've taught that live in Damascus. I think about them all the time. By the way, do you know what the head of Syria today is doing to people in his own city? His name is Bashar Assad. And he, when the people aren't being good, he has barrel bombs. A barrel bomb is a barrel, which is a big object this high and about this big around, you know, a barrel. It's a container. He packs it full of explosives. He puts a fuse in it. He has his army fly over the part of town. Here's Damascus, you know, it's a city like this. And they're having trouble over here in the suburbs. So he sends his helicopter to fly over there. And here's the city, and here are apartment buildings. You know, they're all different heights. People live in apartments because it's a city of over 3 million people. And the helicopter, you know, will drop this barrel bomb. And when it hits this building, it explodes and causes the whole three-story apartment building or four-story apartment building to collapse. He does that to his own people. It's a form of terrorizing them so they won't revolt. But Damascus, everyone says, it's always had people living there. Okay, this is what it looks like today. I took that off Google last night. There's a camera that Google has where it's always, you can do this for any city of the world. It's a sky cam, and Google lets you see what's going on in any city in the world. I'm sure there's one in Jeju. And it just all night long is going like this and giving you a continuous feed so you can see the city. This was Damascus last night. It's a beautiful city of 3 million people. That's what it looks like. What does God say is going to happen? It's going to cease to exist. It doesn't just cease to exist. God says a whirlwind will melt the walls, the rocks of the city, and it will cease to exist. That's interesting. Isaiah says Damascus is going to be taken away from being a city. Damascus is the only city in the world right now that has had people living in it continuously from as early as any scientists know people lived anywhere till today. What Isaiah said, what Cody just read, has never happened. And do you know what? People that don't believe the Bible point to Isaiah 17. They say, huh, see? God doesn't know what he's talking about. Damascus is the proof the Bible's not true. Because Damascus has always had people living in it. It's the most longest, continuously inhabited city on earth. Longer than Beijing, longer than Seoul, longer than Jeju, longer than any part of Egypt. Damascus has always had people living in it. Well, let me just bring you up to date. How many of you were alive in 2001? Anybody? Most of you? Okay. So is anybody 18? Is anybody under 18 here? Ah, David. Other than David, all of us lived through this. In fact, most of you were too little to even know what happened. On February 16th, something was going on called Saddam Hussein. Anybody ever heard of him? He was the dictator of Iraq. He was angry at the United States and the world, and he sent his entire, he had all these soldiers and divisions and tanks and aircraft. He sent them across the border into Syria to join with the Syrians, and he decided he was going to attack Israel. He decided that on February 16th, 2001. I'll just read to you from the news. On February 16, 2001, there was a combined American-British air raid against the command center 20 miles north of Baghdad. I can still remember, I watched this on TV. You could watch on TV and it showed all these bombs going off. It was the Gulf War, it was called. The intention was to preempt Saddam Hussein. A few days later, U.S. satellites picked up six Iraqi divisions moving westward, including ground-to-ground missiles with launching equipment, and the U.S. intelligence community estimated it would be ready to launch Thursday evening, the 22nd. Israel set their forces on alert. Syrian President Assad granted permission for the Iraqi divisions to cross Syria and to shoot their missiles at Israel. Well, the short of what happened is the head of England, his name was Tony Blair back then, called the President of the United States, which was George Bush back then, and he said, we're gonna have to do something, because he said, the Israeli ambassador just came to me and said that Israel will not allow that to happen, and that they have deployed six. Do you remember I told you about the bomb that Israel developed called a neutron bomb? They have neutron bombs that are like atomic bombs, except they only kill life. They don't hurt anything else. And Israel informed Bush and Blair that on February 16th, they were going to neutron bomb Damascus, Baghdad, and the six divisions. And they just said, they sent a map. They said, these are in our Jericho missiles, which land within 2 feet of their target. And we have six already in the silo. And Damascus will cease to have inhabitants alive. Baghdad will cease to have inhabitants alive. And all of the Iraqi army will be dead inside their tanks if you don't stop them. So Israel threatened Syria, Iraq, the US, and UK. They told the US and UK, you either stop them or we will kill them all. And they told Baghdad and Damascus, wow. Did you know that goes down in history as the closest we've been since World War II with Nagasaki and Hiroshima? Remember, the United States dropped over a two-day period, very rudimentary atomic bombs. They were kind of like a high school science project. They were so little. It was the first time we understood nuclear warfare. Those bombs were only in the tons, thousands of tons of explosive power. These things are in the millions, so they're 1,000 times. Millions of tons of explosive power, not thousands. They're 1,000 times stronger. Israel said, and guess what the U.S. did? The U.S. told the Soviet or the Russians, either you make your friends stop coming across the desert, you make Syria and Iraq back up, or we will. But we're not going to let Israel start an atomic warfare. We don't want that, because Israel is committed to never being conquered again. They call it the Samson principle. Do you remember Samson? When he was with the Philistines, what did he do? They tied him to the pillars of the temple. What did he do? He pushed the pillars, and the whole temple came down. The temple of the Philistines. That's the Israeli policy of military. They said, we're never going to be conquered again. If you come against us, we're going to knock everything down and get you too. They call it mutual self-assured destruction. So if any nation comes against Israel, they said, we're going to destroy you. That's the same thing the US and Russia have been doing, and now the US and China and everybody else. But we've never had anybody little doing it like Israel. Okay, so basically the events are shaping up. This is probably going to happen again, by the way, because today Iran is filling Damascus with missiles to shoot at Israel. Do you know how many they've every day airplanes land in Damascus every day with missiles on them. Every day they're flying from Iran to Damascus every day. Another plane arrives and they offload missiles. So far they have offloaded 30,000 missiles that have been made in Iran. Did you know last night they fired 200 of them at Israel? Last night, 200 of these missiles were fired at Israel. You can watch on, if you guys watch the news, they're hitting the streets of Israel and blowing up, and cars are driving away from them. It's really awful. But they're just little missiles, and they're not harming, they haven't killed anybody. They're just bothering Israel. Every day, Iran wants to do this. One day, Damascus is going to send a missile that's going to trigger a war that Israel survives in and Damascus doesn't. And you know why that especially is interesting to me? Because I teach a group like you, only all of them are Arabs. And I teach in a seminary. And in fact, Mr. Stubbs came with me the last time I taught there, Jim Stubbs. And the students are all men who are church planners and pastors in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, Sudan, Egypt, Algeria, all over the Arab world. I have students that email me from Damascus. Remember I told you about the barrel bombs? One of them is a church planter, and he emailed me and said, it's Sunday morning, I'm preparing for the service, but I can hear the explosions, they're blowing up apartment buildings, and he said, they are 10 city blocks away. 10, that's a mile. He said, I can tell that because you count how many seconds between the flash and the pow, you know, and you can tell, it's like lightning, you can tell. And he said, so pray for me because he said, I don't want to, you know, have church if they're gonna blow our building up because then it would get rid of all the people that are witnessing for the Lord. Well, it's coming. Okay, why is all this important? Because God put Israel right here, surrounded by enemies, Egypt, Midian, Edom, Moab, Ammon, Aram, Canaanites, Philistia. And that's because God wanted them to need him. This is when Isaiah is working. It's the Assyrians. And look how big the shaded area, that's the Assyrian Empire that was coming against Israel. Now, all the empires have come against Israel. The Egyptians, God delivered them from in the Exodus, the Hittites, the chariots came down, the Assyrians we're talking about, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. But this section that we're looking at today, the impending conquest, God says, of Egypt and Ethiopia, because they sinned, so God is going to, and by the way, it's conquest of Egypt goes in that blank. And look, Ruth Ann got it already. The next one in chapter 22, it says the Medes are going to take Babylon. Basically, what God says is, you sin against me, I am going to come back and repay you for what you're doing. But the biggest one is this one. And this is what we have 3 minutes to get to. Y'all see the guy on the right? That's one of the most famous warriors of all time. His name is Alexander the Great. When he was 12 years old, he was a general in his father's army. 12 years old. He was already leading an army. He died at 33, and look what he did in his short life. He went from Pella over there in Macedonia and went all the way to India. Egypt conquered the whole world of his day. That's called Alexander the Great. That's why he's called the Great. Isaiah 23 tells about one event, Tyre. Now, you've never heard of Tyre. Today, Tyre is just a rock. In the time of the Bible, Tyre was kind of like Singapore, Hong Kong, Shanghai put together. It was the largest commercial seaport in the world. It was an island off the coast of what's today Lebanon. And God said, Tyre, in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 26, Tyre is going to cease to exist. Well, it was a magnificent city. In 740 BC, God said, Tyre the Magnificent is going to cease. Alexander destroyed it 400 years later, just like God said. In fact, if you take the time, it says that he would build a ramp to the city, that he would take the city and crush it and move it and pile it in a pile. It says all that in the Bible. That's exactly what Alexander the Great did. It was one of the most amazing military victories in history, but it was described by God. The statistical probability of that ever happening, for God to tell how a city's going to be destroyed 400 years before it happened, if you were doing the odds statistically, it's impossible. In fact, one person put it this way. If you took the whole island of Jeju and piled up coins and made one coin red, like this little band right here, and dropped it in the whole island covered this deep with coins, the likelihood of you finding the red one statistically would be greater if you just walked around the island and stuck your hand in once and found the red one. That would be a greater likelihood than this happening, because there are so many details that are impossible. Okay, chapter 28 has the same thing. God predicted the Assyrian captivity. The rest of the chapters, 29, is about Jerusalem, Egypt, and then all the nations. But we're going to conclude with this. Go to Isaiah 35, and I'm going to read before the bell rings. Because there's always a happy ending. After God does all this, going to destroy Assyria, Babylon, the Medes, Tyre, look what it says in verse 4 of 35. Say to those who are fearful-hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God comes with vengeance. He will recompense. He will come and save you. Look at verse 10. And the ransom of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, with everlasting joy on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. The good news is God's going to win. The bad news is that he never overlooks any sin. And when we come back, we're going to see that in the next section.